We are so fortunate to have such a diversity of wildlife in our state, and some of those wildlife are here year-round, some leave for the winter, and some only show up when it's cold and snowy outside. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. There is something to watch for and marvel at in every season here in Wisconsin, and although it might surprise you this time of year, obviously no exception. David Drake, one of our guests, and talk about that, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor or full professor? Are you a full professor?
Full now.
You're a full professor.
Somehow I got through.
The man's a full professor. Great to have you back, David. Thank you. And great to have Jamie Knack with us as well. Jamie, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forests and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have you back.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Always a lot of fun to talk about wildlife. And you know, I wanted to, well, first let me send out an invitation. If you have a question or comment or experience to share in the wildlife area, join us at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a great wildlife photo you want to share and a question or question, you can go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. You can do that. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I want to talk about the Christmas bird count. That is, it's the longest running citizen science birding project, I believe, isn't it, David?
Yep, it is. And it is a very interesting story behind this. So the Christmas bird count.
How far does it go back?
So the very first one was on Christmas Day in 1900.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it is incredible. And it was started, one of the people who suggested that it occur was this gentleman named Frank Chapman. And for people who are birders, he was a noted and famed ornithologist, but one of his hats that he wore was he was the curator of the bird and mammal collection for the American Natural History Museum in New York City. And so just as a digression quickly, one of my favorite stories about Frank Chapman is he used to walk around New York City, and he would bird by looking at women's clothing articles, because back in the early 1900s, women adorned their clothes with bird feathers.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
I can't remember what the count was, but I think it was something along the lines of one single day of walking around New York City, he recognized, I think it was 73 different bird species.
Wow.
Just solely based on the feathers on women's clothes. So that's and we've come a long way since then, and the Christmas bird count is a good example of kind of that conservation era. And so what they used to do is have this thing called a Christmas side hunt, where people would choose sides, and they would go afield with guns, and whoever came back at the end of the day with the largest pile of feathers or fur, they won that Christmas side hunt. And usually there was some wagering on it and things like that. So Frank Chapman said, hey, instead of doing this, why don't we do a Christmas bird count? And we'll go out, and instead of harvesting things, we'll go out and we'll observe and count and see how many birds we can count on Christmas Day. So the Christmas bird count started in 1900. It's still going strong today, and it's not just in New York City, but it's across all of North America. And there are transect routes that are repeated every single year. So our department, the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, has got one of the longest standing transect routes here in Madison. But essentially, the Christmas bird count, it's a citizen science event where people will go out and they will count as many birds as they can find in one day period. And typically, it occurs between December 14th and January 5th every year. And so, obviously, with the Christmas bird count, is complementary to the breeding season bird count. So Christmas
sure.
bird count gets those birds that are there at that time of the year, Christmas time. So in the northern climates, it's usually the resident birds. It's not the migratory birds, because all the migrants are typically the migrants have left our area. So it's really a study of those resident bird species, as opposed to the breeding bird count, which occurs in the springtime, which is a count of all the birds that are breeding in that area or that state. And the breeding bird survey is very similar to the Christmas bird count in that transect routes are run and repeated year after year and things like that. But the nice thing about it is anybody can do it. There are organized count teams, not only here in Madison, but across the United States and Canada. And you don't have to be an experienced birder. If you've never birded before, you'll get teamed up with people who are experienced birders, and you can go out and do it. It is an awesome
way. A lot of fun.
It is awesome. And so if you're interested, the easiest thing is just to Google Christmas bird count on your computer, Audubon Society will pop up who organizes the Christmas bird count. And then there's some links in there that you can find a way to get involved in your local area. But it is an awesome thing to do by yourself, all ages, family event, things like that. And it's extremely valuable for avian conservation. It's a long-term trend count, so see how birds are doing population-wise, health-wise, and things like that.
Yeah, it's really, really something. I have that many years to have those data for all those years and to be able to look back and compare is unbelievably
It's really
valuable.
Impressive.
Well, Lurton in Oshkosh up next with a question, so let's go there. Hi, Lurton. Huh? Lurton it is, I believe.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is, now that you can see those squirrel nests up in the tippy tops of the trees, how possibly do the squirrels attach one leaf to another or hold up one twig before they can add something else to it?
Well, they certainly have watched squirrels carry material for building the nest, but they will gather leaves and stick them in their pouches, you know, in their mouth, and just really shove their cheeks full and then bring them up and pack them. I'm not sure about the material, if their saliva has a tacky nature to it that helps it adhere, or if it's just a matter of how they kind of press those leaves and weave them around the branches on the tops of the trees. So, it's a pretty interesting, just like a lot of the bird nests that the birds make too, some of the swallows and the mud nests. It's pretty amazing. They are pretty amazing architects.
Yep, they are. Squirrel nests are called Dre's, D-R-E, and Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre, the rap artist, they took Dr. Dre, I think, stole it from the squirrel nest. But so they'll make multiple Dre's. So one squirrel will use multiple nests over the course of the year. And you can also look up in the trees, and sometimes you'll see crow's nests up there, which look a little bit like squirrel nests, but crow's nests are flat on top, where a squirrel's nest really looked like a basketball, rounded all the way around.
One early fall I watched, and maybe I'm pretty sure I've said this before on the show, but I watched a squirrel move her young from, she was up in her nest, and the nest would shake, and out she'd come with one of the young hanging onto her neck and underneath her belly, and she down the tree over not 20 feet to another tree, up that tree and installed the young one in that new nest, and then went back and forth doing that.
Yep. Yeah. And so I'm not sure anybody knows exactly why they move the young like that, but it's most likely to protect them from predators, because predators will start keen in on, you know, food sources and things like that. But the other issue, or the other thought, is that those nests sometimes can get full of parasites and mites and external parasites like that. And by moving them, that it moves them to a clean area where they're not being attacked by these parasites. And then it will let that parasitic load kind of die down in the previously used nest.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought about that. Rick, thanks again, Lurton. Appreciate your call. Rick in Mequon. Your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just picked up my deer meat from a processor between Milwaukee and Madison, and I know they did about 1,200 deer, they told me. And I'm curious as to what the consensus is on CWD recommendations and exposure when you've got a plant that's processing that many deer, and just what your people there think about what recommendations there are as far as trying to get your arms around what that means to guys that are eating venison for 30 years. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Well, Rick, that's a good question. I want to start out by at least making sure that I get the information out there where you can learn more about chronic wasting disease, current surveillance efforts in the state, and current prevalence rates. So for up-to-date information on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin, if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and in the keyword box type in CWD, you will get to those pages. So you can look at their recommendations to the questions that you are asking. We are still sampling. The state had a goal, I believe, of sampling about 4,000 deer throughout the state for chronic wasting disease in an ongoing kind of monitoring effort for the disease. They had about 64 registration stations, taxidermists, food processors, and kiosks where heads could be submitted for sampling. So that will be continuing to go on. So if you submitted a deer lymph nodes for testing, it'll take a couple of weeks to get that result. a lot of decisions are made depending on what part of the state you're hunting in and where the deer was harvested from, whether it was in an infected area or not, and is, you know, and somewhat, you know, up to the landowner or to the hunter to get that deer tested. As far as consumption, the World Health Organization and others still recommend that if you have a positive test, you do not consume that meat. So that being said, I'm not sure what else I can really, you know, add to it.
I will say some of the plants that process the deer advertise the fact that they process each deer
individually.
And clean after each one. So.
Yes. Yep. So that is something that I guess I do myself anyway, is kind of seek out those types of facilities where you are getting your own deer back or your own meat back. And I do that because we take a fair amount of time and effort and carefulness in trimming out the deer. And you probably have a mixed spectrum of you know, time that folks take with that effort. So that's something that you can do as well. And like I said, you know, the DNR website will have additional information there.
The only other thing I'll add to that, Rick, is I certainly understand your concern, but to my knowledge, there's not been any study published in either medical or scientific literature that has documented that even if you are eating an infected CWD deer, that it's transferred to, and shown up as some kind of a disease in human beings. And obviously, for humans, it would probably show up as the what's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So scientifically, there's no evidence so far that it's been transferred from deer to humans.
Thanks again for that question. We have open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's take a look at on our Facebook page. Daniel sent a really nice photo. He says, this was the view from my deer blind last week. There's a wild plum thicket at the edge of the woods, and this is a really pretty shot. Unfortunately, I could not get a picture, but I had the wonderful pleasure of watching a pair of northern shrikes hunting and gathering. This is the first time I've ever heard them vocalize, so it was so cool. I probably missed a dozen deer crossing fields, but it was worth it.
That is a really neat picture and an even better story. And so we have two species of shrikes in the state of Wisconsin, so northern shrikes and loggerhead shrikes. And typically northern shrikes will stick around for the year, even through the winter, and loggerheads will move out of our area. And so we were just talking about the Christmas bird count. I typically do participate in our department's transect route, and usually at the Fish Hatchery DNR off South Fish Hatchery Road here in South Madison, we usually pick up a northern shrike that is sitting in the habitat similar to what Daniel showed here in his picture, and they're usually sitting on one of the taller trees in the area. So it's neat to see them. The other thing that's really cool about shrikes is they're kind of a medium-sized, maybe a little bit larger than a robin, grayish blackbird. Their top bill is hooked or curved like a raptor bill. And a lot of times shrikes are famous for impaling their food source on the barbs of barbed wire fences or on thorns of trees and shrubs and things like that. So if you see a mouse or grasshopper impaled on a thorn or a barb of a barbed wire fence, it's a good chance that a northern shrike or a loggerhead shrike's in the area.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock, there's a new book out called Do Unto Animals. It takes a look at how we should interact with animals. Kathleen Dunn talks with the author about the animals in our world and the better way we can care for them. That's at 2 today here on the Ideas Net. We're talking animals right now, as a matter of fact, our wildlife in Wisconsin with David Drake and Jamie Nack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. What kinds of wildlife have you been noticing lately? What are they up to? Any experiences to share? Love to hear it. You can also go to our Facebook page. We've got one beautiful photo up there right now. You could post a photo if you would like, or post a question there as well. And the Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. We have Jay in Plum City up next with a question. Jay, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, just to follow up with that CWD discussion, you know, if you live in a rural area, the deer come up to corn cribs or concentrate on dump feed, or even just in nature, deer will concentrate and exchange saliva under, like, acorns, you know, acorn tree. And I'm just wondering why, you know, folks think that restricting baiting is really going to help much with the spread of CWD when there's going to be saliva exchange at all these other potential sources, you know, mineral licks, corn, waste grain, that, you know, and I don't really know that it's going to do a thing. That's what I'm asking.
No. Okay.
Well, thanks for the question, Jay. And this is something that's been debated in the state for a number of years. And again, this isn't up to the Department of Natural Resources. This would take a legislative change for, you know, this to be in place. But the concern is that baiting of deer, and you could include feeding or, you know, of deer as well, can concentrate deer, just like you had mentioned, even over natural food sources, whether it's acorns and things like that. But baiting is typically an unnatural source and can concentrate deer to the point that they have additional nose-to-nose contacts. There's fecal matter, saliva in that general area, and it's been shown that CWD can be spread from that contact. So it would not... Eliminating baiting would not eliminate CWD, but it would potentially reduce the spread of the disease, and that's kind of where that side of the baiting discussion is what they're looking at.
Thanks a lot for calling, Jay. Appreciate it. Jeanette in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Jeanette. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about, I just saw a little brown bat hanging outside this building, and I called the bat people, and he said that they won't survive because there's nothing to eat. And so I was just going to remind people that if you see a bat outside, call the Humane Society or the bat people will tell you who's licensed in your area to take them in and overwinter them, because he said he won't make it. And I just wanted to throw that out there.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, Jeanette. Is she still on the line?
Yeah.
Can you clarify maybe who you contacted? Was it the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources?
No, it was some guy. It was Soft Prairie or Sun Prairie. Or anyway, it's personal. This guy has a personal line in his home, and he told me that the local Humane Society is able to be able to take care of him, so to call them. But you can look on the internet and you'll find someone who'll give you guidance. But yeah, they can't make it, and so he just came and got it. I just want to let you guys know.
All right, very good.
There is, within the Wisconsin DNR webpage, there's a wildlife rehabilitator directory that you could also look at. Those rehabilitators are usually specialized in the animals that they care for, but you can start by looking in your county and see if you have somebody who does specialize with bats. I would recommend that it's always best to make a phone call first before you remove an animal from the setting, unless it's in danger right away, because it may be that with this warmer weather, maybe the decision would be that bat is okay. It's got another week here before it gets too cold and so on. But better to ask a professional on how you should proceed, so that you can get the advice in terms of wearing gloves and maybe even have that professional come out and do that removal with a species like bats. And then in addition, she's exactly right. There are special multiple county areas, so those bats that are removed from the wild and rehabilitated or you know, kept over winter, they want to make sure that they get released back in the general location where they were taken. So there are some guidance documents in terms of how far that animal can be taken from its original capture area. So but again, always always ask a professional first before you remove an animal, just to make sure you're doing the right thing.
Something like be tough for something like a bat that, I mean, primarily they're eating insects, right?
Yes,
so what
absolutely
happens in the wintertime?
Well, and some of our bat species migrate, but the little brown bat that she's talking about is one of our hibernating bats. So it is correct to be concerned if you see any species of bat at this time of the year. So it's good to inquire and make that phone call to your local biologist or call the DNR call center and ask for their support in finding a rehabilitator.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette, thanks again. Appreciate the call. Sue in La Crosse, Your turn. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Hey, I got a question about woodpeckers. I feed the birds. I try to feed them. Well, I don't really feed them all summer, but, you know, throughout the year. And I always put suet out in the winter. And I never see a woodpecker land on the ground. Do they ever land on the ground? They're always either in a tree or on my feeders.
Yeah, so that's a good question. And we've got a good variety of woodpeckers here in Wisconsin, the largest being the pileated,
yep.
Or sometimes you hear it called the pileated woodpecker.
Yep, I've had one of those.
Yep, and one of the smaller ones is the downy or the hairy woodpecker. The downy is a little bit smaller than the hairy. But there is one species that does spend a considerable amount of time on the ground, and that is what's called the northern flicker, or also called, sometimes you hear them referred to as the yellow-shafted flicker, because yep. The underside of their feathers on their tail and wing have yellow shafts. And one of the characterizing field marks on those birds is they have a red stripe down the middle of their head. So the and then the other issue is when they fly, you'll see a white butt or a white kind of flash in their tail between the wings. And the reason those species or that species spends on the ground, either the northern flicker or the yellow-shafted flicker, same bird, is that up to about half of their diet is made up of ants. And so they'll spend a lot of time in your lawn picking ants out of the grass.
Okay.
You really commonly see them on the road shoulders as you're mm-hmm. driving on the highway. You'll see them in the gravel and flushing kind of as you're driving by, and you'll see that white rump patch that David mentioned.
Okay. Two years ago, I was lucky enough in Peninsula State Park to see a pair of pileateds with two young, and the two young were on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they were. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and the parents weren't real happy.
Yeah.
You're vulnerable.
Yeah. I've never seen, like, the hairy woodpecker on the ground or the downy, either one.
Yeah, so those woodpeckers are primarily up in the trees. For the most part, it's the northern flicker is the one that if it's on the ground and you had to choose which woodpecker species, if you choose northern flicker, you know, 99% of the time you're going to be correct about that. But most of the other woodpecker species in our state are in the trees gleaning insects out of the bark and things like that.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. I thought maybe it was – maybe they're, you know, like a loon, how a loon you never see on land because
yep.
their legs are set so far back.
Yep. Yep.
And I thought maybe the woodpecker was the same way, but I can never tell because they're always in the tree and, you know, sideways. And
yep.
So I'm thinking, well, maybe that's the deal. But, okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're yep. welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. The next caller is Tom from Green Bay. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I want to say something about shrikes, but I've seen hairies, downies, and red-bellied on the ground, especially around the bird feeders when they're picking up sunflower seeds. We have our woodpeckers are feeding on those, and they will pick them up off the ground. Now, as far as shrikes, I've banded both species in the state of Wisconsin. They don't have a hooked bill. They're not a raptor. They're a passerine. Their adaptation is a notch in the bill and very sharp bill, which is like a razor blade. That's why they're one of the nicknames is butcher bird. They carry things in the bill. They don't use their feet to carry things. They're hang things up on thorn trees, barbed wire fences, and then they're cut them up with that very sharp notched bill. The notched bill, the notch is for killing. And it's the same thing you find in your falcons, Falconidae.
Well, I guess politely disagree. If you look at some of the bird books, some of the pictures, they've got a hooked upper bill, and as a matter of fact, the textual description of some of these shrike species also includes a hooked bill. So we may be arguing
semantics
about whether you want to call it a notch or a hook or whatever, but it is not as pronounced, obviously, as a raptor. That top hook bill, but there is a bit of a hook to the top of the bill.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have, you know, it's hard to believe, and I want to give, by the way, let me give the number before I go off with what I was going to ask here. The number to call, we have open lines, get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mueller Show. I wanted to get to some, you know, things relating to the holiday season. It's here we are, December, holiday shopping time. What are some wildlife-related gifts, and I know you've got a lot of gift ideas, Jamie.
Oh, there are so many different things to pick from. I'm going to present maybe a wide array of different types of gifts to think about that maybe some, you know, are come right to mind and others that are maybe not gifts that you would have thought of. So thinking about either donating or, and you could donate in somebody's name, or joining or renewing or starting a membership with a group. So whether it be the Natural Resources Foundation, a conservation organization like the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, lots of nonprofit, your local Audubon Society. So lots of memberships that you could think of to give somebody this year. Another would be that I think is a really great way to stay in touch with natural resources issues and outdoor recreation throughout the year is the Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine. So it's a real, it's a steal. It's 6 issues for $8.97
per
year.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great publication.
I haven't got a chance to look at it yet. I saw it online, but the December issue has an article on the elk reintroduction efforts and also the northern invasion of hawks and owls, which talks about the one we usually highlight is the snowy owls, which have been seen again this year. But it's interesting because it talks a little bit about the issue or having a code of ethics in terms of how we observe these hawks and owls as they visit, because they are in vulnerable states. They're often mm-hmm. weak, undernourished. And then with social media now, we're putting mm-hmm. on Facebook and all the sightings on eBird, you know, where you can go and see these, that word travels fast. And now we've got a lot of people out there trying to get good close pictures. And unfortunately, that can really harm these birds as well, in that you're forcing them to fly and expend energy and maybe not necessarily be able to refuel that energy that's lost. So anyway, that magazine I really look forward to every other month and think it would be a great gift. And there's the standard, you know, bird feeders. You could do a gift certificate to a wild bird food store.
I've done that.
Yeah. Well, it's not,
and that's always well appreciated. Bird seeds.
It's not cheap.
It's not cheap.
Especially, you know, the high quality, whether it's Niger or mm-hmm. black oiled sunflowers. If you really focus on a high quality seed, or just gift certificates for those types of places. Heated bird bath would be another great idea. And along with those would be a bat house, and a bat house that would be Bat Conservation International certified, so BCI certified, built to the specifications of that organization. So those are a few. I've got a few more, but maybe we'll save them for a little later.
Yeah, we can talk throughout the show about, just bring a few up here and there. Bill in Ashland, though, has a comment, so let's go to Bill. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. You guys are talking about the violated woodpecker landing on the ground, or woodpeckers in general?
Yeah.
Yeah, this happened to me, I saw this a couple of years ago. I had a garden. I was sitting out there, and it was in the evening, you know, and you're just kind of enjoying things, you know. And this pileated woodpecker landed on the ground, and it started hopping around, looking around, just like a robin does, you know, cocking its head and things, you know. It jabbed into the soft ground. It was getting insects out of there. It was there for, oh, gosh, a good 10 minutes doing that. Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to share that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, Bill, that's a good observation. I should say, you know, the previous caller, Tom, also made the observation about other woodpecker species on the ground. And I don't mean to indicate that other woodpecker species cannot get on the ground and feed, and they certainly do. But, you know, the more common of them all is the northern flicker, and there's no doubt that other woodpecker species would get on there. And, Bill, you mentioned that they kind of are cocking their head from one side to the next side. And one of the reasons birds do that is with the exception of some of the raptors, most of the birds have what we call monocular vision, or they have an eye on each side of their head. And so what they have to do is they cock their head, for example, to the right, and then they'll cock their head to the left. And by doing that, they are able to view out of both the right and left eye within a relatively short period of time, and then they put that image together in their head. So unlike our eyes, which are both centered on the front of our face and similar to the two raptors that need that that depth perception, most birds have monocular vision, and that's why they're cocking. They kind of look like Muhammad Ali bobbing mm-hmm. in the ring right there, but they're cocking their head to one side to the next side to put that full image together of what they're seeing with monocular vision.
Very cool. Thanks again, Bill, for calling. Mike in Eau Claire, turning to you next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, just two things. Firstly, what a great program. This is my first time listening, and I felt apt to call in with a question that's bothered me for some years.
Sure.
So when the DNR is determining programs such as Earn a Buck, determining how to monitor and control deer populations, I was just wondering, how exactly is that done, or just a brief overview of how that process is done? Here in Eau Claire County, where we're 50% woods, 50% field, does that vary from something, let's say, in Buffalo County or the southern regions where it's more field or more woods? I mean, I just confused as to how that process has actually gone through.
All right. Good question, Mike. Thanks.
So, Mike, I'm going to have Jamie, and I know Larry knows quite a bit about this as well, so I'm going to have all of you jump in on this and maybe add to this answer. But, you know that historically and for the long time, every time you shot a deer, it had to be registered through a check station within 24 hours of harvesting that deer. And at that check station, they would sex and age the deer, and then that information would feed into what they call the SAK model, the sex, age, kill model. And the DNR would use sex, age, kill, and they would build a population pyramid, and that would kind of give them a sense about what does the overall statewide as well as relatively local population look like, and then that would help them kind of guide what the harvest for the next season is going to be like. In recent years, and probably within the last 5 or 6 years, I guess, it has changed a bit because there was an audit of the DNR's deer program by Dr. James Kroll and a couple of his colleagues. And that was the Kroll report that came out, and they have since suggested to get away from that sex, age, kill model, and that's why this year they went to what's called the e-registration, where you could register your deer over the phone. So by registering your deer over the phone, they've lost that valuable information of the sex and the age, and they don't have that valuable information to feed into the SAK model, that sex, age, kill model. So now what they're looking at more is the health of the habitat where the animal is, and generally are asking people to look at the health of the animal. And so if an animal's emaciated, the indication would be possibly that the habitat is not healthy enough to support that deer or that local population of deer. Or if the habitat is in good shape, then you probably are close to what is a reasonable deer management goal for that area. But as part of that evolution of the deer management program here in the state, recently they've come up with what's called CDACs. It's the County Deer Advisory Committee, and that is a committee made up of a number of people that represent a varied interest group. And the County Deer Advisory Committee now is tasked with making recommendations on harvest for that particular county. And they're trying to, instead of getting away from these, they've gotten away from these, what they call deer management units, and have brought it down to a county-level deer management unit or area. And that County Deer Advisory Committee now has quite a bit of say in what is going to be harvested for the next 3 years out. Jamie and Larry, do you want to add anything?
The only thing I'll clarify is that in the past, when we aged deer, or deer were aged with the Department of Natural Resources, it was typically opening weekend, and they would work at registration stations and age. And I believe, if my memory serves me, it was around like 40,000, 45,000 deer of the couple hundred thousand that were harvested were aged. So they had that age structure. And now with e-registration, they're just looking for other means of capturing that information. So they are still collecting it. They're working with meat markets or butchering facilities to be able to get the jaws at that point, or for landowners who might be in the deer management assistance program, getting them to submit their deer jaws at the end of the year so they can gather that age information. So there's been a lot of changes with the deer management system from going into a county system, so we don't have the historical, or it looks different. It has to be repackaged. We don't have the benefit of looking back at the historical trends and management and you know, kind of getting at those numbers. So
there we go.
More to come.
Yeah,
yep.
That's a good clarification. But it is a very storied history with deer management in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and it's. The one worry that I have, and I'll just speak personally here for a minute, is that it can be, when it gets down to that county level, it, depending on who's on the committee, it can get to become a political kind of thing. And that's one thing that I would be very sad about as opposed to the actual science.
Well, and we didn't necessarily talk about it. I think it goes without saying, but deer are, they can have a large impact on people for a variety of reasons. And there's a lot of stakeholders when it comes to deer management, from those that want to see fewer deer to those that want to see more deer. And it's difficult in terms of balancing the biological carrying capacity and the social carrying capacity. So it is a no-win situation no matter what you do. if anybody's interested, I'm sure there's additional details and the history of management or how deer are currently being managed on the DNR's website, too. That would be helpful.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. James in Eagle River has a question, so let's go to James. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. I grew up in central Wisconsin, a little village of Camp Douglas, and there's a nearby town called Nisida. And on Facebook, there was a trapper who posted a picture of a bobcat that he trapped in the Nisida area. And there was discussion back and forth about how much harm that trap may have caused to the bobcat. The bobcat was alive and he released it. You don't hear about bobcats in the Milwaukee area. They've been talking a little bit about cougars every now and then showing up. But what can you tell us about bobcats in the state of Wisconsin? Yeah. I'll hang up and listen.
That Nisida Wildlife Area is a pretty big area, and I'd expect to see bobcats
there. Yeah, for sure.
So I'm trying to pull numbers off the top of my head here. I want to say roughly 4,500 bobcats in the state, with about 500 permits issued on a given year, harvest around a couple hundred. They can be both hunted and trapped. In terms of a picture that you saw with the trapped bobcat, it is typically foothold traps that are used for bobcats. They're a very nice trap in that it allows you, if you do have an incidental catch, so this person maybe perhaps was trapping coyotes or a different species, it allows the release of that animal with hopefully no harm to the animal. So those foothold traps are designed to hold the animal, and it's important to say that trapping in Wisconsin is highly regulated, just like hunting. There are rules, and there are also BMPs that have been passed, so best management practices for the use of humane traps in the state. So otherwise, in terms of like fur bearer surveys, those would also be on the department's website, so you would be able to look at past harvest records for bobcats, but just off the top of my head, those I believe are the numbers. There is research going on looking at the expansion of the bobcat population, which was typically in the northern part of the state, but they have been expanding into the central and southern parts of the state as well. So a very interesting animal, pretty secretive. You don't often get a chance to see them, but just a beautiful animal. So thanks for the question.
Yeah, I'll mention, just to add on to what Jamie said, and to kind of tie into a Facebook post here from Brian in Milwaukee. And Brian just mentioned, Larry, that he lives along Oak Leaf Trail in Milwaukee and regularly sees a bunch of wildlife. And so a great reminder that we don't have to venture far for thrill-in wildlife sightings. And bobcat, I think, are one of those species that are pretty adaptable and probably more adaptable than we expected them to be, you know, decades ago. But they can be considered an urban wildlife species. And as a matter of fact, last year there was a bobcat sighting verified at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum here in Madison. Mm-hmm. And in other urban cities and centers around the United States, bobcats are regularly showing up. So they are pretty adaptable. And the fact that they're harvesting them sustainably is also an indication that their numbers as a population are pretty healthy. Otherwise, they wouldn't have that harvest occurring.
Well, and this was one of our other Christmas gift ideas we were going to talk about, but trail cameras with the high interest in trail cameras, not just from a scouting perspective for hunting purposes, but for just the pure sake of, you know, what's
your own backyard.
What's out there when I'm in bed, right?
Yeah.
We see that's how a lot of these reports are coming in. There's a friend of mine from Columbia County that sent me a picture of a bobcat on his property. And, you know, that's the southern part of the state. So we're getting a lot of those reports. And, you know, that leads into Project Snapshot Wisconsin, which is trying to deploy cameras out to get a census of some of these more I don't want to say rare in this case, but, you know, elusive animals or ones that aren't quite as common. So pretty interesting tool, and they would make a great Christmas gift as well.
David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Our guests, I'm Larry Mueller, Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today as we take a look at the world of wildlife in Wisconsin with David Drake and Jamie Nack. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And let's go to Don in Dairyland next. Don, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm up here in northwestern Wisconsin, and I've noticed over the past few years it's getting to be quite an extreme overpopulation of bears.
Okay.
And I was wondering, years ago, because I'm an old-timer, years ago you used to be able to shoot a bear if you had a deer permit, you know, or a deer tag. And we need to control the bears, I think, a little bit better than what we have. And I was wondering, is there a possibility that it could happen again, that we could maybe have an open season for bow hunters and rifle hunters? If they see a bear, why not knock it down? You know, meats.
Go ahead.
So, Don, what I can tell you is that black bear in Wisconsin have really become kind of a trophy animal in that we have some of the most phenomenal black bear hunting in the country. So on an annual basis, there are over 100,000 people who apply for a black bear permit. And depending on the management zone, and I don't want to get too detailed here, but depending on the management zone, it could take 6 or more years of applying before you actually draw your tag. Okay, so there are roughly 25 to 30,000 bear, about 11,000 or so permits issued on a given year, with about 4,500 to 5,000 bear harvested annually. So the state is looking in terms of, you know, sustainable harvest here of that bear population. If we were to give tags, and that success rate is fairly high, that's almost a 50% success rate. If we were to allow every deer hunter the opportunity to harvest a bear, when we just had 600,000 folks in the woods for the deer season, it would not be a sustainable harvest for the bear population. So you're not alone in concerns about the current bear population in the state. There are folks who share your concern about a growing bear population, but we do have very good records on the bear population. They also are mandatory registered upon harvest. A tooth is also submitted, so we have age information. So the best I can tell you is we have a real state-of-the-art management system in place to manage and monitor bear populations, and are able to increase the quota or the number of tags issued to achieve the goals in terms of harvest for a given zone. So again, to read a little more on that or look at past harvest histories, you could get that material from the DNR's website. But at this point, the bear hunting in the state is just really, there's a lot of interest, incredible amount of interest.
Don, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Gil and Baraboo a chance to join in. Gil, your turn. Thank you for calling.
I'm not sure if this is a question for your guest or for a game warden, but I've got some hunting land with a old drainage ditch on it, and beavers have decided they wanted to build a dam there. I removed the dam 2 or 3 times, and I haven't discouraged them. So I need to trap the animal, and I'm a little confused in the regulations. It looks like I could go and do anything that I want to, but if I hire a trapper, he's got to stay a certain distance away from where the dam was. I'm wondering whether he can be my agent, or if he can, I don't know anything about trapping. If I can go out with him and he can place the trap and show me how to do it, whether that is acceptable. And I'm just not sure what the regulations really say.
Yeah, Gil, that's a good question. And I'll just preface my answer by saying if you have any doubts at all, and even after what I tell you on the radio, you still may want to just check with your county DNR game warden or a conservation officer just to double check and make sure that you're in the clear here and doing things legally. With that being said, beavers are one of our fur bear species, and there is a regulated season. If you're a recreational trapper, there's a regulated season for trapping beaver. However, beaver are also the largest rodent species in North America, and they can be a pest, and they can cause considerable damage, mostly from flooding, but obviously they also chew and cut down trees as they're chewing and things like that. So more pertinent to your question. As a landowner, beaver are one of those species that you can harvest or kill at any time on your property that damage is occurring, and you do not need a license to do so. However, for a trapper, if you were to hire a trapper or ask a trapper to come on, they would be what's considered an agent of the landowner, and they would lose that exclusivity or that exemption, I should say, that they would then have to follow all regulations and trapping regulations and things like that, and they would not be able to trap that beaver, for example, out of season if they're acting as your agent. And even if you're accompanying them, it doesn't matter. But the other issue you mentioned about the dam, one of the trapping regulations is you cannot set a trap within, I think it's 25 feet of a dam, simply because there are so many other animals that use that dam, the top of that dam, as a travel way, that you would get a secondary catch or incidental trapping of a non-target species would be highly probable. And so that's why you're not able to set on a dam. And you would not want to do that even if you were trapping yourself as the landowner.
I would. I've walked across many a beaver dam in northern Wisconsin, and they're pretty sturdy.
Yeah, they can be for sure.
Pretty sturdy things
for sure. But the only other thing I'll mention is again, double check with your conservation officer for your county if you have any questions. But the other resource out there, if you want, is go to the Wisconsin Trapping Association. Just Google Wisconsin Trapping Association, and there's a list of trappers usually for each county that have registered to help assist landowners with various problem animals like beaver. And that trapper, you just make sure that they're licensed, and you might want to ensure that they've got some kind of insurance if they come in your property, so if they get hurt, they're covered. But that, trappers, just like most hunters, are very ethical people, and they're professional, and they know what they're doing. And you can generally be rest assured if you get somebody off the Wisconsin Trappers Association that they'll be very, very helpful to you.
All right.
Okay. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, thanks, Gil, for calling. Appreciate it. And Maggie in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What?
I have a question on long-tailed weasels.
Okay.
I saw three of them this last week up at our hunting land, and they were, I didn't know what it was because it was all white, and then I looked them up, and it said that they turn all white in winter except for a little black tip on the tail, which is exactly what they looked like. And I'm wondering if what I did see was a long tail, because it said, is the long tail more common than the short tail weasel, is what I understand?
Well, I think they are. So just to back up a little bit, there are three weasels in the state.
Right.
There's the least weasel, which is the smallest. They all turn white. The least weasel does not have the black tip, although it may have just a few black fine hairs, but it doesn't look like it's been dipped in a paint can.
Yep.
The middle one is the short-tailed weasel, which is also referred to as the ermine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the long-tailed weasel, the largest of the three. And they are widely distributed in the state, but relatively uncommon. I would hazard to guess that the short-tailed is more common than that long-tailed, but they are very hard to tell apart without being able to look at them, in the hand and take measurements. So I think it's probably safe to say that you saw either short-tailed weasels or long-tailed weasels, but they are super fascinating to watch. You had a chance to do that.
I did. For a long time, I saw them three different times, and at first I just saw the one, and then I saw two smaller ones with it, and I thought it was her babies. But then I looked it up, and they have babies in May, I think. And anyway, and then at three different times, I saw just the single one, and they don't seem shy at all. I didn't seem to scare him. He just kept, you know, he'd go up and down a tree, and we have lots of rocks with crevices, and he'd sneak inside those, and then he'd turn around and just watch me. Absolutely fascinating and cutest animal ever.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Maggie. Really cool story. We have, I went on Facebook, on email question from Rich that I wanted to bring back up because he missed the magazine suggestion that you gave earlier. And go back
over
that.
Yeah, so the magazine I suggested to stay in tune with natural resource issues affecting the state and kind of year-round outdoor pursuits is the Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine. And it's available for $8.97 for the year. I think it's just a bargain. I mean, it's under $10.
Bargain.
I can't believe that. And so that's 6 issues a year, and you can find information by going through the Wisconsin Natural Resources.
Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Yeah, it's put out by the agency, but if you Google Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine, you'll get there, or you can go through the DNR website and search it.
That's a gift I can afford.
There we go.
Yeah.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests, they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store. Then we'll be back. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Wonderful to talk about our Wisconsin wildlife. We do it at least once a month, and pretty much more than that, as a matter of fact, usually two or three times some aspects of wildlife. And today, David Drake and Jamie Nack are back from the Department of Wildlife Ecology. David's with UW Extension as well, and a full professor of forest and wildlife ecology. Jamie is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them along, and thank you for listening. If you have a question or comment, join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Gary in Madison has a question, so let's go to Gary. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I live on the west side of Madison in a pretty populated area, not far from the West Town Mall here. We do have greenways and such, but pretty populated here. And recently we've had about 5 coyotes that are traveling together in our neighborhood. And I was a bit alarmed at it, that all 5 of these are together and they seem to be hanging around in the neighborhood here. And last night, you know, they were screaming just right across the street from my house. And it kind of keeps us, you know, into the house. We're not really don't want to be out. And I am just wondering, one, you know, what kind of danger does this present? And two, does it make sense to have these removed from the neighborhood in somehow, and how would we do that?
Okay.
Gary, that's a good question. And coyotes and red fox, I will say, are becoming a very common sighting in Madison and most urban areas around the country. And one thing I'll say, I'll just take this opportunity to plug a program or a research project we've got going on here called the UW Urban Canid Project. And if you want to Google that, a Facebook page and a website will come up. Mm-hmm. And one thing I would suggest, Gary, if you don't mind, if you want to email me personally, ddrake2@wisc.edu, we'd be interested in coming out and perhaps trapping the coyotes, not to remove them from your neighborhood, but to study and research them. And so one of the things we do is live trap or humanely trap the coyotes and red fox here in Madison, ear tag them and put a radio collar on them, and then we track them around to find out more about their activity patterns, how they're using these urban landscapes, how they're living in and amongst human beings and things of that nature. And so we'd very much like the opportunity to come out to your neighborhood if you've got coyotes there and try to study them a little bit more. And that will also help you and your neighbors better understand the activity and the ecology of these animals. The one
Are
thing,
we in oh, danger of them?
No. So the one thing I'll say is when you see coyotes typically are a pack animal, so they operate as a pack. And it's not unusual to see, you know, an average pack might be 5 to 7, something like that, especially in the city. And so the best thing you can do for yourself and your neighbors and your pets, and the best thing you can do for the coyotes is to put the fear of humans in them. So when you see them, what the best thing to do is go out there with pots and pans or scare them by yelling at them and raising your arms and making big waving motions with your arms or something like that. But the more fearful they are of humans, the more they're going to peacefully coexist with us. And there's no way we're ever going to be able to get rid of them in Madison. We can trap every single one of them out of Madison if we want to. Mm-hmm. But other coyotes will fill that void, and they'll come back in here. And so the better thing to do is try to figure out how we can peacefully coexist with them. And one thing is put the fear of humans into them, so scare them every time you see them. Don't feed your pets outside. If you've got a compost pile, try to wall that compost pile off, because even if you're not putting food scraps from your table out there, their prey items of coyotes are using that compost pile, most likely like mice and rabbits and things like that. You know, there's other feeding mechanisms in your yard. If you're bird feeding, as that seed drops to the ground, that's feeding small mammals, which then might draw the coyotes into your yard. So things like that, if you have especially a small pet, like a smaller dog, don't let the dog outside, especially at night, without your supervision. If you're walking the dog, make sure you've got the dog on a leash. Just, you know, smart things like that will help you to coexist with these coyotes. But, the chance of an attack, I'm not saying that it's not possible, but the chance of an attack is very, very small, especially on a human being.
So okay, so can I get your email address?
Yes, it's DDRAKE. And then the number 2, so ddrake2@wisc.edu, the first four letters of Wisconsin.edu.
Okay.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling.
And we'll probably be out sometime this week to look around.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Gary, for calling. And Patricia in Portage, your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I write the Mad Raven Speak Living Wildlife column for the Cap Times, and I have a couple comments. I've just been listening to this on the road here, and beavers are being trapped out mercilessly in this state on $5 licenses. And beavers, the American Indians called beavers the sacred center of life because they create. They are one of the species. They're like the perfect animal. They create habitat for half of the rare and endangered species on Earth, probably rare and endangered because beavers are so persecuted. And they are water keepers, and water is the new oil. I mean, water is going to be so important in the future because we are depleting our aquifers and doing all sorts of terrible things to water, and they are water purifiers. They are absolutely the most perfect animals. So if that guy wants to bring those beavers to my creek where I live near Portage, I would love to have beavers back in my creek.
Well, hi, Ms. Randolph, first off. It's nice to hear from you again. Not to say the beavers aren't also, they've got tremendous amount of benefits. They are they dam up water areas, so that provides good wetland habitat for a whole host of species, animal and non-animal alike, and things like that. But they do occasionally cause issues. As, again, flooding is one of the primary issues, and that conflict or that negative part of the beaver also has to be managed sustainably and responsibly, but it does have to be managed.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. We have several emails and some Facebook comments as well. A Facebook photo from Kay with a shot of her son with a deer that he had shot. He said, a lot of people told my son that he shot a mule deer here in Wisconsin. Why do some whitetails look like this? And I'm just looking, and I'm thinking probably because of the white swash across the neck, and maybe because of the dark fur.
Yeah, the darkness on the head. I mean, I've seen a lot of deer, obviously, and this is, you know, my profession and what I went to school for. I mean, that looks very much like a whitetail to me, but it could be, I don't know what of it people are looking at and considering it a mule deer or asking if it's a mule deer. And I agree with Larry. It might be the white throat patch, but we do see that on deer. The main difference when you're comparing the two species, and to clarify, we have white-tailed deer in the state, but as many of you are aware, there was a mule deer that was shot recently that, you know, is kind of an unknown origin. It may have moved from a western state into the state, and we have had sightings of mule deer over the last couple of decades, so it's not without possibility that there be a mule deer harvested. But to tell the difference between the two, the key factors that I think of are the white rump patch. So not in the front of the deer, but towards the rear, back. It's going to have a white rear end. And in terms of the bucks, the antler growth is different. So in white-tailed deer, absent maybe some of the non-typicals, you're going to have antlers coming off of one main beam. And in the mule deer, you're going to have forking. So the antlers may fork off of each other as they grow out of the main beam. And I think if you go online and look at pictures of the two species, you'll see what I'm trying to describe.
And we have, I wanted to also point out that we were talking about bobcats earlier, and Brandon sent a shot, a photo of a bobcat from his trail cam near Richland Center just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and there has certainly been sightings of bobcats, you know, statewide at this point. So,
yep. Thanks a lot for those photos and those questions. Steve in Mineral Point has a question. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just drove past Spring Green and I saw 100 or more cranes out in the fields, and I was wondering if should they be gone by now?
Steve, that's a good question. So sandhill cranes are typically one of the last birds to migrate from our area, and so it's not uncommon to see them, you know, into November for sure. Certainly down here in the southern part of the state, maybe not necessarily up in the northern part of the state. But as Larry kind of introduced the program at the top of the hour at 11 o'clock, it's been a strange winter so far because we've had such a mild winter, you know, not much snowfall and things like that. So some animals are a little slow leaving the state, and sandhill cranes are certainly taking advantage of what is still available to them in terms of habitat availability and food availability and things like that. But one of the reasons you're seeing such large numbers is they're starting to stage, and then as they stage and they gather in large groups like that, they're getting ready to start migrating south. So they probably won't be there much longer, although I was looking at the long-range forecast, and it's supposed to be up into the 50s, at least here in Madison, you know, well into next week. So it has been a strange winter so far.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. Thank you, Steve. Derek in Tomahawk has a question. Hi, Derek.
Hello, how are you guys and gals?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Great. I have maybe a theoretical question, as we haven't collected the data on it yet. But as I see the state of Wisconsin moving more and more toward getting more and more hunters into the woods, more and more people enjoying the outdoors, more and more people into the outdoors, which I think the thought behind it is great, but it seems to me just to be to generate revenue at the cost of the resource. So by that, I mean we have just recently passed now, hunters can wear bright pink as a ploy to get more women into the hunting practice. We have a youth hunt that allow 10-year-old children to fire high-power rifles at moving targets to, in my opinion, increase the amount of license sales. We have increasing counties, states, counties and townships going to ATV, more ATV usage on roads, and then to go from a in-woods trail to a road and then back to an in-woods trail. So they've opened up more county roads for that usage, which spreads invasive species.
What's your question?
Are we leading ourselves off of a cliff here? Are we looking at a tragedy of the commons? Are we loving this resource to death? Where do we draw the line at at the demise of the resource for, let's say for this example, maybe money.
Okay, so we're looking at forest health here.
Yeah, Derek, that's a pretty broad question in general, but I will say this, that most of, especially the public land base, is used for multiple uses. And so what is occurring on public lands, as long as it's legal and it's allowed to be there, there's quite a few things and a diversity of uses of that land base. And so you mentioned ATV use, for example. Not everybody may agree with the use of that public land base, but as long as it's legal to do so, it's allowed. And I'm not going to say that economics are driving this. It's not because the natural resources, especially wildlife, it's not a economic commodity. So there is certainly money being made from wildlife in terms of license sales and things like that generate money to support the Department of Natural Resources budget, for example. But it's not as if it's a commodity that people are constantly trying to sell and sell and sell in order to make more money, because there's no profit margin there. And I don't know. The only other thing I'll say is, if you look at our history in America and go back to the 1800s and early 1900s, where we were in that dark history of market hunting compared to today, certainly we've got a lot of endangered species and rare species on the landscape. There's no doubt about that. But to over-harvest or overuse something necessarily, and I'm speaking primarily about wildlife here, I think would be pretty difficult to do, because there is so much science involved in the regulation and the management and our ethics and our understanding of resource use and sustainable resource use. Again, speaking about wildlife, is so much more advanced than it was 100-plus years ago. So I understand your concern. I'm not sure that we're going to overuse the wildlife resource just simply because the regulatory and management and scientific framework is much better than it was historically.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to turn back to Christmas gifts when I think of Christmas, I think of Christmas trees. And I have a Christmas tree, and there's a tree sale for southern Wisconsin that you wanted to mention.
Yeah, I'd like to spread the word here, but the UW Forestry Club, so within our Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, it's our student organization on the forestry side, they have an annual Christmas tree sale, and it occurs right on campus at the UW Stock Pavilion that is at 1675 Linden Drive. And it's occurring this weekend, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, starting at 8 o'clock and going until about 8 o'clock at night. It's the 42nd annual year that they've been selling Christmas trees and some fir wreaths. And species include Fraser fir, balsam fir, white pine, and Fraser fir for the wreaths as well. And one note, they have a history of selling out early. So if you plan to go, you need to get there by Friday or early Saturday morning. They do fairly well, especially if it's a good weather weekend. So if you haven't gotten your tree, come on out and help support the Forestry Club. The sales will help them with their student career and professional development opportunities within their program at UW-Madison.
But be prepared. I think they only accept cash or check,
yes,
not credit cards.
Correct.
So make sure you bring cash or check with you.
Sarah in Lake Zurich, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Okay, well, for one thing, I just read that they're trying to start a bobcat hunt here in Illinois, and I didn't even know we had bobcats in Illinois.
Yeah.
So, but it hasn't been finalized yet. Okay. Anyway, so here where I live, I know there's coyotes, and my roommate and I both have cats. My roommate has an enormous cat. He's the biggest cat I ever saw. I mean, we call him Bigfoot. He's so big. And I worry about him going outside, and I'm hoping that his enormous size will make him less tasty to a coyote. Do you think that coyotes go for smaller animals? Like, could I have any peace of mind about that?
So, Sarah, probably the best advice I can give you on this one with the cats. So coyotes are going to take prey opportunistically, you know, when it's available to them. So typically, you know, they're going to eat rabbits and small mammals and things like that. But given the opportunity in an urban setting or even a rural setting, they'll take a cat. They'll take a cat. They'll take a small dog. And you know, again, the safety of that cat, just like David was mentioning with small dogs, if you do have a small dog, obviously they need to go outside to use the bathroom. You know, keep them on a leash, and especially at dawn and dusk, keep close supervision with them. It would go without saying with the cat as well, to keep it closely supervised and not turn it out. That's going to actually help the wildlife as well, because cats are pretty efficient predators and are good at eating songbirds and other small mammals. So best thing you could do if you do want that cat to get some fresh air, keep it on a leash, monitor it, and bring it back in at night.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Sarah, appreciate your call. Yeah, it's bad. I mean, your cat's going to live a lot longer.
Yeah, I think the statistics are an indoor cat lives twice as long as an outdoor cat for life expectancy. So
a lot of
dangers out there, from crossing roads to diseases that can come from wild animals and those coyotes, right?
That's right.
We had a Facebook question from Teresa. A friend of hers has found three bats in her home over the last 4 to 5 months. What's the best course of action to be sure there isn't a colony or that they are gone? Right now, you don't want to do anything if they're in the house.
Yeah, I think that right now, Teresa, the four bat species that we have in the state at this time of the year are our resident bat species, and they are hibernatory. That's the way they survive the winter time, because there's no food source for them. So the best thing to do right now is just let them be. They're not active. They're just up there sleeping. They're going to sleep through the whole winter. And then as we get into the springtime and our day length starts to lengthen or grow greater in number of hours, that's kind of the primary cue that wakes those bats up, as well as the warmer temperatures. At that point, you can then go and have somebody investigate whether you have a bat in your attic or not, or perhaps between the walls. But if you're not comfortable going up there and doing that yourself, there are people in the Yellow Pages or on the internet that you can find under typically pest control, and you might need to call around and just ask, do you deal with bats? Make sure you find somebody who's reputable. The other thing you can do is go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources page and type in their search engine bat or bats, and some information will come up about that, about how to go about handling a colony in your house as well. But if you don't mind, just wait out the winter, let them sit there, and then as we get into spring, you know, sometime in March or so, then you can start to investigate this issue.
There we go. Thanks very much for that. And we're, I think, pretty much out of time here. I'm looking at the clock, it went by pretty fast. Somebody wondered about the wolf population. Just briefly, it's pretty large.
Yeah, right now, I mean, they're back on the endangered species list, so they're protected. I think the last minimum count was in around the 750 in terms of numbers of wolves, and that's a minimum track count that's done over the winter. They are still primarily packs and individuals are in the northern and central forest part of Wisconsin, but it's not uncommon to have individuals just like the bobcats and bears and fisher to occasionally show up in the southern part of the state as well.
There we go. One other gift that I was going to mention is the wildlife phenology calendar for Wisconsin. And Stan Temple is going to be on the show tomorrow from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And he's going to talk about phenology and the phenology calendar. So that's another one. You'll hear some more about that tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you, guys. You'll be back soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'll do it again. Jamie Knack, Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. David Drake, Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension and Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And they will be back. Tomorrow at 11, we will be learning about the new Wisconsin Wildlife Phenology Calendar. Then at 11:45, we'll talk about a book that explains the amazing ability of horses and their connection with you and with me. Thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.